You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 67, Leviticus chapter 5. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Very good, very good. Good to be back in the Leviticus some more.
Absolutely. Well, we're trucking right through, so I'm excited about number 5.
Yeah, I actually got a comment on the blog that someone said, hey, I learned something from Leviticus. I had an aha moment from Leviticus. So
yeah, I agree. I think the biggest thing that I've taken away from it is the decontamination thought process behind it.
Yeah.
That was really an aha moment for me.
Well, good. Well, today we're going to hit chapter 5. And for, again, those who listened to the last episode, chapters 4 and 5 were laws governing sacrifices of expiation. In other words, they had something to do with atonement. We talked about what atonement meant in Leviticus, basically the idea of purging or wiping away, not covering. And then also the concept of forgiveness, meaning, you know, we talked last time in Leviticus 4 about sacrifices for inadvertent offenses. So there was really no moral issue. So the concept of forgiveness was that God looks at the person bringing the proper sacrifice and sort of the matter is settled. God looks upon that favorably. You know, you did what you needed to do with the right attitude and it was inadvertent and we're good. So that was chapter 4. And I had made the comment in that episode and also probably at least once before that, you know, when we hit this section, we're going to be reading about sacrifices concerning unintentional offenses, unintentional sins. And basically, that's what the sacrificial system is about. I mean, if you do something defiantly, we talked a little bit about this already, then there were more severe consequences for that. And in many cases, there's no sacrifice. There's nothing you can do about it. And we're going to get into more of that today in Leviticus 5, but we're going to see an exception to this. But the exception, again, really isn't about moral absolution. The exception is something that is done intentionally. And if there is regret, and there's only a certain types of offenses where this would apply to. If there is regret, then the guilty person is allowed an opportunity to pay retribution or reparations is probably a better way to say that. To just, you know, restitution is the word I'm trying to think of here. So there's an opportunity to pay restitution, not retribution. That's the wrong word, but restitution or reparations. So chapter 5. You will see sometimes in commentaries and literature referring to what most English translations have as the, quote, guilt offering. It's better rendered, better understood as the reparation offering or the restitution offering. So you'll see that at some points in the literature. So we'll get there in chapter 5, and we're actually going to spill into chapter 6 a little bit because in the Hebrew Bible, the first 7 verses of chapter 6 in English translations are actually in chapter 5. So when we get to that point, I'll just issue that reminder again so people, you know, will wonder, well, why are you going into chapter 6? Well, the answer is, well, we're not really in chapter 6. We're in chapter 5 according to the Hebrew Bible. There are not a huge number, but there are a fair number of instances, you know, I guess you can chalk this under Bible trivia, where the versification of the Hebrew Bible is not the same as the versification in English Bibles. Sometimes that's due to the Septuagint, sometimes it's not, sometimes there are other reasons, but it happens. And we're going to hit one of those today. So let's just jump into chapter 5. Last time it was the sin offering, the decontamination offering in Leviticus 4. Leviticus 5 is going to be the so-called guilt offering. So let's, you know, just jump in here. We might as well start with the first 13 verses. And the first 13 verses of chapter 5 still involve some language about the sin offering. You're still going to see the sin offering mentioned. And I said this during the last episode that, you know, the sin offering stuff spills into chapter 5. And this is just another reminder of that. But you're going to see references to sin offering procedures, but then you're also going to get other offerings mentioned. For instance, in Leviticus 5:7, there's the mention of the burnt offering, and also later in the chapter, the guilt offering. And I had made the comment before we introduced Leviticus that sometimes the offerings will overlap, in that certain things will happen where the offerer either is required to or can bring more than one kind of offering, again, depending on what the situation is. So let's just read the first 13 verses here of Leviticus 5 to start off here. If anyone sins in that he hears a public adjuration to testify, and though he is a witness, whether he has seen or come to know the matter, yet does not speak, he shall bear his iniquity. Or if anyone touches an unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean wild animal, or a carcass of an unclean livestock, or a carcass of an unclean swarming thing, and it's hidden from him, and he has become unclean, and then he realizes his guilt, or if he touches human uncleanness, of whatever sort the uncleanness may be, with which one becomes unclean, and it's hidden from him, when he comes to know it and realizes his guilt, okay, these are all parenthetical statements. Verse 4, or if he utters with his lips a rash oath, okay, or if he does this, or if he does that. Basically, the feel here is that you become ritually unclean in some way and you don't know it. Verse 6, he shall bring to the Lord as his compensation for the sin he has committed, again, even though he didn't know it. And the word compensation there is asham, which is going to be the word for the quote-unquote guilt offering. Notice ESV translates it compensation. There's restitution idea here. If you become unclean, you don't know it, and you sin unknowingly, then you bring the Lord your compensation for the sin that has been committed, a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat, or for a sin offering. So right there you have a reference to the asham, the guilt offering, and in the same verse, the sin offering, the katat that we talked about last week. So here you have offerings overlapping. And the priest, the end of verse 6, shall make atonement for him for his sin, for his transgression. And even though he didn't know about it, but when he comes to know about it, there's something you need to do now. You need to become ritually pure. Verse 7, but if he cannot afford a lamb, then he shall bring to the Lord as his compensation. There's the word again, asham, as his compensation for the sin he has committed, two turtle doves or two pigeons, one for a sin offering. Okay, so the compensation, the asham, which in many translations is guilt offering, the compensation is both for a sin offering and the other pigeon for a burnt offering. So now you got three offerings referred to here in verse 7. So again, the reason I'm reading through this is because really two things, to show you that, again, offerings overlap. Remember, the burnt offering was so that you could approach the Lord. The katat, the sin offering, is actually a decontamination offering. So that, again, decontaminates sacred space, sacred objects. It insulates holy things from you because you're ritually impure. And then this, we're getting into material in Leviticus where what you're bringing is also viewed as a compensation for something. That's going to become more explained as we keep going in chapter 5. So the overlap is I think, significant that we take note that this actually does happen. And also, again, to introduce the idea, the second reason I'm reading through is this compensatory idea, this restitution idea is going to be important in this chapter. So continuing with verse 8, so the guilty person shall bring them to the priest, who shall offer in this case the two pigeons. The first one for the sin offering, he shall wring its head from its neck, but shall not sever it completely. And he shall sprinkle some of the blood of the sin offering on the side of the altar, while the rest of the blood shall be drained out at the base of the altar. It is a sin offering. Then he shall offer the second for a burnt offering according to the rule for that one. And the priest shall, quote, make atonement for him for the sin he has committed. He shall be forgiven. So again, you will be purged of your impurity. That's the atonement language, purged of your impurity that you have incurred upon yourself through something you did with really inadvertence, without real knowledge of it. And God will be good with you. Okay, you'll be taken care of. There will be sort of nothing to your account. Verse 11, if he can't afford two turtle doves or two pigeons, you got to be pretty poor here, then he shall bring as his offering for the sin he has committed a tenth of an ephah of fine flour for a sin offering. He shall put no oil on it, shall put no frankincense on it, for it is a sin offering. Again, those are the rules for the sin offering. And he shall bring it to the priest. The priest shall take a handful of it as its memorial portion, burn it on the altar. On the Lord's food offerings, it is a sin offering. Thus the priest shall make atonement for him for the sin which he has committed, any one of these things, and he shall be forgiven. And the remainder shall be for the priest, as in the grain offering. We talked about the grain offering earlier. So those are the first 13 verses. And there are some issues here we need to talk about. These 13 verses deal with, again, what scholars might refer to as acts of neglect. In other words, there's in verse 1, there's this failure to testify on some incident, and the rest would be some sort of thing that you did that rendered you impure that you didn't really know about. And so there was a failure to deal with the impurity until the point is reached where you are alerted to the fact that, oh, I didn't realize that I've become ritually impure. I better take care of that. So the first 13 verses here tend to be referred to by scholars as failures of or acts of neglect or sins of omission or something like that. So there's that issue sort of to properly frame them. But there's an issue with the first one at the beginning of the chapter. And I'll read it again. If anyone sins in that he hears a public adjuration to testify, and though he's a witness, whether he has seen or come to know the matter, yet he doesn't speak, he shall bear his iniquity. Now that sounds very deliberate. Doesn't sound inadvertent at all. But the rest of the stuff in the next 12 verses is clearly inadvertent. So what the problem is, what's the relationship between these things? How do we understand everything in the 13 verses when you have the first thing in the first verse seems different in character than what follows in the next 12? Well, there's basically three views of this. Some scholars see all of the acts of the first 13 verses as intentional, all of them. But the act of verse 1 is singled out as defiant, as deliberate. Well, I should say deliberate and defiant aren't the same thing in Leviticus. Deliberate is, it's not inadvertent. I mean, you made a decision to do this, but defiant is sort of an attitude issue, an intent issue, sort of there's a pomposity to it. Again, a defiant sort of stance, you know, I don't care what God says, I'm going to do this, as opposed to, well, I'm afraid to testify and I think I'm not going to do that. Again, it's a little bit of a motivation difference. So we want to be careful to observe that. But some people say, hey, they're all intentional. Only this one is defiant. So that one is, since it's defiant, this view says, is why the verse says that person's going to bear his iniquity. But the rest of them, again, are not intentional. They're not defiant. And so there's provision for sacrifice. Okay, that's one approach. Second approach, some scholars would see all of these acts of neglect as intentional, but none of them are defiant, even the first one. That is, they would characterize the person who doesn't testify when he's been publicly, when a public call has been issued. Hey, if anybody knows about, you know, who did this or that crime, you need to say something. Some scholars would say, well, maybe the person's just hesitating. It's still deliberate. It's still a decision, but they're not doing it defiantly. And so some would say all of these things are intentional, but none of them are defiant. We don't have to read defiance into the first one. And then naturally that raises the question, well, then why does the first verse say he shall bear his iniquity? Well, the answer would be the bearing of the iniquity would speak to the fact that whatever circumstances were sort of described in the public adjuration, the public call to testify, this person may still suffer consequences, but it's still not defiant. And that takes us into, we need to say something about what this public adjuration is. The public adjuration, again, was a sort of a forceful call to the community that if anybody knows what's going on or what happened here, who the guilty people are, you need to come forth as a witness, lest, and then there's typically some sort of consequence for not coming forth. That's all I want to say right now, because I'm going to get into what the specific Hebrew term means in a moment. But the call to adjuration isn't just sort of a, like today a cop goes on TV and says, please, you know, please, 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 you know, testify, you know, help us solve this crime. It's a little stronger here in Leviticus, again, by virtue of the term that's used, and also just the culture. The culture was, you know, you need to come forth, because if you don't and we find out, then there's going to be consequences. There's a little bit of a threat that goes into what the ESV has translated here as a public adjuration. So, but some people would say, look, yeah, okay, somebody hears that, decides, so it's intentional, not testify, but it's still, it's too much to call it defiant. Okay, maybe they're just afraid. There's some hesitation. Third view is that some scholars would see the act of verse 1 as intentional and not covered by sacrificed, deliberately to contrast it with the rest. And the rest are unintentional violations that can be addressed by sacrifice, as in prior portions of Leviticus. Well, you know, personally, I'm just going to give you where, you know, my thoughts on this. I think the second option is probably the least likely. Again, the second option was that all of the acts in the first 13 verses are intentional. I just don't see that, because I think the language is clear from verses 2 to 13 that people just don't know if they did something wrong. So I don't see how that it can be intentional. So I think the second option is probably the least likely. If the first option is correct, that all of the acts here in the first 13 verses are intentional, then this would be a passage. It's one of a handful in the Old Testament where there's still an opportunity to sacrifice, even if you do something deliberately. But even if that's the case, we're still not dealing with a defiant sin. So there's no sacrifice solution for defiant sins. If the third option is the best one, well, then it's still true that sacrifice only addresses unintentional sins. So, you know, there's a difference of opinion here. It's not terribly important. I think we are going to get some clear exception language as we go on. So when we hit that, you know, I'll mention it again. Now, before we leave verse 1, I want to go back to this "he shall bear his iniquity" in this public adjuration idea. So the first verse again says, if anyone sins in that he hears a public adjuration to testify, though he is a witness, whether he has seen or come to know the matter, yet he doesn't speak, he shall bear his iniquity. Now the Hebrew word here that's in the ESV that's translated public adjuration is Allah, which elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible, this is kind of interesting, refers to a curse that's, you know, put on someone. Isaiah 24:6 is an example of that. Just look at that verse quickly. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, again, on Allah. It can be a curse laid on, in that case, you know, sort of a general curse statement, devour the earth, curse devours the earth. It can also be a specific curse laid on someone, an individual. Ezekiel 16:59, for thus says the Lord God, I will deal with you as you have done. You have despised the oath in breaking the covenant. Again, the oath language there is this adjuration. So God is going to punish someone directly for that. You have, let me see if I can find another one here. Proverbs 29:24, the partner of a thief hates his own life. He hears the curse, that is the Allah, but discloses nothing. In other words, he's called on to testify and he doesn't do it. So he's willfully putting his own person under threat. He's risking potential harm. The same word Allah could be a curse that's part of an oath, part of a covenant, treaty, agreement, that sort of thing. So without belaboring it too much, this public adjuration often would include consequence, cursing language that, hey, we have a situation here. We need witnesses to come forth. And again, it's more than just, oh, please help us. It's, hey, we want to know who did this so the guilty is punished and not the innocent. And if we find out later that you knew, then here are some consequences. And those would actually be issued in the public call for witnesses. So that's why the language is what it is really in verse 1, that this person is going to bear his iniquity, even if it wasn't defiant. Let's say he's just fearful. Well, if they find out later that guy knew, there's still going to be consequences, even though it wasn't this high-handed, defiant, snubbing God kind of attitude. So even if he didn't have the worst attitude, he could still suffer consequences. Certainly if he's defiant, then, you know, there are going to be consequences if they find out. I mean, people might regret, like, oh, why didn't you come earlier? Why didn't you just respond? You know, even though we know, you know, you weren't doing this defiantly, there's still consequences. We still have to follow the law. We still have to follow this adjuration. And now you're stuck. That's one thing. You know, if someone's just doing it like, well, you know, screw you, you know, kind of thing. Well, then, hey, we don't really care if there's consequences. You know, we're certainly happy to dish them out. So you have just, again, sort of an odd situation there. Let's go down to verse 14. And this is really sort of the heart of the matter for today's episode. This is when the quote unquote guilt offering gets a little more detail. It's already been mentioned, and it overlapped with the sin offering and the burnt offering. But I want to say something more specifically about the guilt offering. So here's the rest of the chapter. It's only five verses. Verse 14, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, if anyone commits a breach of faith and sins unintentionally in any of the holy things of the Lord, he shall bring to the Lord as his compensation. There's that word again. The Hebrew word is asham. Again, usually translated guilt offering. But he shall bring to the Lord as his compensation a ram without blemish out of the flock, valued in silver shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, for an asham, for a guilt offering. Now, ESV actually takes the same word there. Let me read it again. He shall bring to the Lord as his compensation asham, for a guilt offering, asham. It translates the same word two different ways. First time compensation, second time guilt offering. Again, exactly the same terminology. I don't know why they did that, because frankly, I think translating it guilt offering, okay, the person here, again, it's still unintentional. If anyone commits a breach of faith and sins unintentionally, it's still a violation. It's still unintentional here. In a couple of verses, we're going to get into some things that are certainly intentional. So there's still guilt. And so I get the idea of translating it guilt offering. But why don't you do that in the first part? He shall bring to the Lord as his guilt offering. Why translate it compensation? Well, it's because the translator knows, and I think in this case didn't really do a good job, of knowing that the issue with this offering is restitution. So this kind of mixed translation, I think, creates some flawed impressions in the whole sacrifice. Because when, again, what did I say last time? When we hear sacrificial language of the Old Testament, because we're Christians, because we are more familiar with the New Testament, because that's all we ever hear preached, or whatever the reason is, we tend to filter the language of the Old Testament through the New Testament, through the work on the cross. And so when we hear guilt offering, we read that in our translation, we might be led to think that, oh, when the sacrifice is killed, the blood is applied to the offerer and he's clean now, just like what Jesus did. Or that the offering, you know, covers, you know, defiant acts, every kind of sin, just like Jesus does. Well, none of those things are true. It doesn't cover everything. And it's never, the blood of the sacrifice, again, like the other ones, is never applied to the sinner. So again, we're at risk here because we filter the Old Testament through the New, just sort of subconsciously, of misunderstanding. And in this case, I don't think the translation helps. What you need to get in your head is that the quote-unquote guilt offering is about paying restitution. That's the guts of the whole thing. So if we go back again to verse 14, let's just slow down and pick a few things here. If anyone commits a breach of faith, well, what is breach of faith? What is that? The Hebrew term is ma'al, and commentators like Levine, you know, will point out that the etymology of Hebrew ma'al is not certain. That is, it's unclear as to what, you know, sort of comparative Semitic term, what broad Semitic term this one could have come from, because Hebrew has homographs. I've mentioned this before. The Semitic languages are going to have several words that could be behind ma'al. And the question is, well, which one applies, you know, to this, to the one that's used here in Leviticus 5? Well, it's not clear. Levine actually says this. I'll quote him a little bit here. He says, all biblical occurrences of this term relate directly or indirectly to ancient notions of sacrilege and impurity. As such, it is an appropriate term for misappropriation of sanctuary property. It may also refer to betrayal of trust in some contexts, like with marital infidelity. In some contexts, it's used for acts of deceit. In other cases, it's used of a violation of the covenant between God and Israel through worshiping foreign gods. In legal texts, Levine points out the crime of ma'al involves actual loss of property. And so, you know, we'll shut Levine off there for the moment. His view, and I think it's borne out by what, you know, what follows a little bit in the remainder of the chapter, is that the breach of faith here has something to do with the unintentional misuse or destruction or some kind of misappropriation, misuse of sanctuary property. Now, it's clear that it's inadvertent because we have the word, just like we had before, bishgaga, inadvertent, unintentional in the passage. So maybe this refers to the sort of unintentional taking of something that should have been used only for the sanctuary, some sacred object or something like that. It's a possibility. If it is, then this is a good example of if that's done unintentionally, then it can be taken care of through the restitution sacrifice. This is quite in contrast to like what Achan does in Joshua 7, where he goes and deliberately takes something that had been put under the ban, put under the kerem in the tent, and of course loses his life for it when it's found out. Another possibility here is that the breach of faith refers to an inadvertent touching, not necessarily taking, but touching or handling a sacred object. That's, again, possible. A lot of scholars would come down more specifically that it refers to, again, some piece of sanctuary property, not something owed to the priest, like maybe they took part of a sacrifice or ate the wrong part. Most scholars would say this language, ma'al, because of the way it's used elsewhere, when there's clear loss of property or damage to property, probably in this context refers to that same kind of thing going on, that something was associated with the sanctuary itself and was either misused or damaged or destroyed or accidentally taken away from sacred space. If that happens, if there's this, quote, breach of faith, ma'al, and it's unintentional, the point of the verse is that, okay, now you need to bring compensation. You need to compensate the priesthood, the people in charge of the sanctuary. You need to compensate them for this loss. And so you bring a ram without blemish from the flock, valued in silver shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary for a guilt offering. It has to be a certain level of value to it. And in verse 16, he will make restitution for what he has done amiss. That's actually the word kata, which to miss the mark, to sin, as we discussed last time. So you bring restitution for what you've done amiss in the holy thing, and that is the word there for HaKodesh, the sanctuary, and you will add a fifth to it. You add 20% to it and give it to the priest. So that's verse 16, Leviticus 5. And the priest shall make atonement for him with the ram of the guilt offering, and he'll be forgiven. So again, what's going on here is that if you were an Israelite and you inadvertently touched something that belonged to the sanctuary or destroyed it, or damaged it, or picked it up when you were cleaning up, whatever, and off you go to your tent and you realize, when you unpack whatever it is you brought to your tent, it's like, holy cow, this belongs in the sanctuary and here it is, in my tent. What do I do? Because it's a violation. Well, if it was unintentional, and I think this is especially clear if something is unusable again, like if it was destroyed or damaged, then what you did was you took a ram at a certain value. It had to be 20% more than the weight of the shekel for that object weighed, again, the precious metal and all that kind of stuff, whatever metal it was made of, whatever the shekel weight was, you had to compensate 20% beyond that, take it to the priests, and then you were good. And what the priest would do is actually something we're going to discuss next week. It's in Leviticus 7, because in this chapter, the restitution offering is never described as being slaughtered. In chapter 7, it will be. And there's something done with the blood, and part of the animal is, again, a food offering for the Lord. We talked about that before. Another part of it is for the priest. So the priest, the priests have no income other than what they're able to eat in certain kinds of sacrifices. And so this would have been an important part of their livelihood. Israelites needed to make sure that they were doing what they needed to do, not only and primarily, of course, it was you need to take care of impurity so that the sanctuary is not defiled, because there could be serious consequences to that. And there are certain incidents in the Bible that point that out. People die and they get injured or whatever. So yeah, you need to worry about that, but you also need to do this so that the priesthood is taken care of too, because they have no other means by which to support themselves. So it was something that they needed to pay attention to. So probably in these couple verses here, we have an unintentional act, and this is what you do. You pay restitution 20% above. Now, the last three verses of chapter 5 are a little bit different. It says, if anyone sins doing any of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done, though he did not know it, so there's still this ignorance kind of thing going on, but yet it is an act with intention. Okay. If anyone sins doing any of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done, though he did not know it, and he realizes his guilt, he shall bear his iniquity. And not really expected there. He shall bring to the priest a ram without blemish out of the flock, or its equivalent for a guilt offering, and the priest shall make atonement for him for the mistake that he made unintentionally, and he shall be forgiven. It's a guilt offering. He has indeed incurred guilt before the Lord. So there's, again, this feels to many scholars less accidental than the other ones, but you still have this, the person doesn't have complete knowledge of what he's doing, and therefore it's not a defiant act. See, a defiant act would be when, look, I know what I'm doing right now is against God's will, and I'm going to do it anyway. Whereas in this case, there's a question, but you still do it. And you find out later that, yep, you shouldn't have done that. Okay, that's viewed differently than, again, this defiant, sort of arrogant, you know, sinning with hubris, you know, kind of disposition in a person. So the law distinguishes those kinds of intent. Now, Levine writes about some of these verses that regarding the inadvertent misappropriation of sanctuary property in the first couple verses, verses 14 and 15 and 16, that's different than this. And he says, there were no witnesses to the crime. The usual laws of testimony before were not applicable. But in this case, the accused realizes that, yes, I did something of my own will, but I found out only later that it was something I should not have done, whereas before it was like just a complete accident. Nevertheless, he's still guilty, but he is still given the opportunity to make restitution, to make up for it, and there's still an opportunity for this restitution offering. So what Levine, again, is trying to say and articulate here is that, look, this is an instance where it's not a complete accident. It's not completely inadvertent. There is a decision made to do a certain thing, even when you had doubt. And it turns out that you should have listened to your doubt, but you did it anyway. And God knows that you did it anyway. It wasn't a total accident. This was an act of your will, but yet now you realize that you made the wrong decision. You made the wrong decision. And so God, even though there's an element of intentionality here, God still will, if you're repentant, will allow you opportunity to pay restitution for that. So bring your restitution offering and, you know, the priest will make atonement for you and you will be forgiven. So this is, again, one of the few instances in Old Testament sacrificial law where you can have someone, again, make a decision, an intentional act, but still, again, it was something that there was doubt about, but you just made the wrong decision. You just screwed up. And it's different than total accident. But even though God knows that you acted on your own free will and you became guilty, God still looks at you if you're repentant when you do realize what happened and says, okay, I'm going to make an exception here. We're going to allow you to bring a reparation or restitution offering so that you can take care of this. You're still allowed to do that, even though it wasn't done with total ignorance or totally accidentally. So this is sort of, in my mind, kind of an exception that sort of proves the rule. I mean, it was a really serious thing in the Old Testament system for anyone to sin defiantly. You're basically out of luck. Okay, if you sin knowingly, willingly, defiantly, as opposed to total accident or I'm not sure, but I'm going to do this thing and I'm going to take the risk, and then you wind up, you know, being on the wrong side of that risk. All that's different than the attitude of the sinner that just says, who cares? You know, screw God. I don't care about this rule. I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to get what I want. I'm going to sleep with who I want. You know, whatever. You act defiantly. That was viewed quite differently than some of these other circumstances. In other words, God, in this passage, the heart was part of the assessment. It's not just, did you do it or not? It wasn't a black and white letter of the law. This is sort of one of those spirit of the law kind of passages where the intent of the person is factored into what's going on. And the grief that they have over making the wrong decision is factored into what's going on. So I think it's a significant passage, but still, it still highlights the severity of how sin was looked at in the Old Testament. So segueing again to wrap up here, just a few thoughts of how this, you know, might potentially apply to our thinking, and especially how we view this in contrast to or in light of the New Testament. The principle here is that sins that are defiant and for which there's no restitution, and no restitution is frankly possible, you know, have no resolution other than being cut off from the community. So, you know, if you do something defiantly and they're like, if you kill somebody, there's no restitution for that, dude. Now, if you did it accidentally, you know, you have the refuge, the cities of refuge, and the whole Avenger of Blood thing. We've actually commented on that, you know, I think in our first episode or maybe the last one. I can't remember when, but even that, you know, because it was a life or death thing, you know, the law to distinguish. But that's a good case where you can't restore that. you know, you rape a girl, you can't restore her virginity, you know, or her status prior to the rape, you know, as being somebody's wife. I mean, she's violated, and that doesn't go away. Can't make restitution for that. So when you have sins for which there is no restitution, and especially if they're defiant, it's a serious thing. You are cut off from the community. That either means the death penalty or some sort of banishment, you know, we've talked about before. So the sacrificial system just doesn't address that. And those offenses that could be addressed were the ones where there was no defiant intent and there's genuine repentance. You know, there's a voluntary realization, I did wrong and I'm sorry and I want to make this right. But even then, think about it. You couldn't just... Since the disposition of your heart is still an issue, just bringing the sacrifice was not enough. In other words, here's a scenario. Let's say that, okay, I don't know if this is going to render me unclean or not. I'm not sure. I'm going to take the risk. I'm going to make a decision, and then I wind up on the wrong side of it. Well, if my attitude is, oh, you know, I blew it. I'm sorry. I'm going to go to the priest. We're going to make this right. That's one thing. But what if it's like, oh, this is a nuisance? Okay, I screwed up, I made the wrong decision, whatever, and I have to be talked into taking the sacrifice. And my wife says, you better take care of that, or you know, you're going to get in trouble. Oh, yeah. Okay, I'll do that. Well, that's not sorrow of heart. I mean, what was described here in Leviticus, the system, and again, you know, we can sit here and wonder how well was this enforced, you know, sure. But the system was designed to, you know, really respond to the person who was sorry for their sin. They weren't defiant and they could make restitution. There's an opportunity there. It's not, you know, so that somebody could twist their arm and say, okay, you know, I don't like this calf over here. Let's kill that one. That is not adequate, even if it was of the right value. The heart is still an issue. So the sacrifice itself is not going to be adequate in the spirit of the law. A third thought, the restitution offering didn't absolve someone of the moral guilt of the offense. And I think this is an important lesson for us. Again, in what respect? Well, in the respect of, again, appreciating how much better we have it on this side of the cross. The restitution offering didn't absolve the person of moral guilt. In other words, they were actually guilty. That was a fact. The sacrifice didn't make them, you know, like we hear preachers say now, because of the New Testament, you know, rightly so. It didn't make them as clean as though they'd never sinned. That's not what the quote unquote guilt offering did. It's not what the restitution offering did. They were guilty. And when you brought it, everybody knew you were guilty. What it did was it allowed you the chance to make amends. Okay, that's what it did. So it was kind of limited. You're not like morally clean now. Yes, as, you know, the matter's taken care of with between you and God, and you know, you don't put yourself at risk by approaching sacred space or anything like that. The matter's taken care of, but it doesn't make you as though you'd never sinned. It's not like you're not going to be known for someone who had done this. There's still going to be some consequences there, and you know. We have that too today, but in God's eyes, it's a little more clean. We're placed in Christ. You know, God looks at us as though we'd never sinned, and he looks at us and sees Jesus. All these New Testament thoughts, that isn't actually what's going on here. It's that, okay, God says, I know your heart. I know you want to make amends. Here's a chance to do so. And that's sort of where it stops. The frightening thing is, what if you didn't have, you know, enough wealth to make restitution? Because you'll notice in the last three verses, it doesn't talk about, you know, the pigeons and the grain and all that kind of stuff. It's, you have to have a commensurate value sacrifice to make restitution if something was destroyed or not. So you might, in theory, have to wait. You might want to make amends, but you can't do it just right now. You might have to wait. You're sort of in a limbo status or something like that. We don't have to worry about that in the New Testament, but at least in the Old, there was a chance to make amends if their heart was right. And in our case, you know, we can be forgiven for sins. Think about it, for which restitution is impossible. There are none of these limitations in the New Testament forgiveness language. Well, the work of Christ is good enough if you have the right attitude, or if you can make restitution, then what happened on the cross will cover you. But if you can't make restitution, then it doesn't. There's nothing like that in the New Testament. We can be forgiven for sins for which restitution is impossible. And our repentance and faith in God's own sacrifice is sufficient for any circumstance at all. So again, if you're a Jewish reader, or a Jewish convert to Christianity, and you know your sacrificial system, and you read books like Hebrews, or you hear, you know, Paul preach or something about, you know, the extent of forgiveness and whatnot, that's a little mind blowing. It's a little mind blowing because it's so much better than what you had going into that situation. You don't have to worry about, well, what was I thinking when I did this? You know, is God going to look at this as inadvertent or accidental, or am I sure that God's not going to sort of decipher this thing I did as defiant or not? You don't have to worry about any of that. Okay. You are covered regardless of the circumstance and regardless of whether restitution is possible or not. Again, it's just a superior sacrifice, which is the whole point of that section of the book of Hebrews.
Mike, I wonder what the gossip was like back then. You know, there goes so-and-so with a ram. I wonder what he did. I wonder what he's guilty of.
I wonder what he did.
Trey's got two turtle doves. There he goes. I wonder what he did. Can only imagine the gossip back then.
Yeah, because it's visible.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to take the things to the sacred area, and people are going to see that, family members, people who aren't family members, and they know the system.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
There goes Mike with a...
Yeah, it'd be like, you know, I mean, I'm not a Catholic, but it's like if people see you going into the confession booth, it's a poor analogy because, you know, like every good Catholic is going to say, well, we all sin and that kind of thing. But but there's still this, we know you had something to take care of, even though we know we all do. But the fact that we saw you go into that confessional booth, or we saw you take that animal or those two pigeons or whatever, I think you're right. You know, like it would start tongues wagging. It would start suspicion.
Yeah, it's a whole nother level of accountability. If you've got to walk this animal through the village and everybody knows what's going on.
Yep.
That's something to think about.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, I'm not going to say it's not an advantage, because it is. You know, you take things privately to the Lord, but still, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, we take that advantage and we sort of, I mean, we can, I'm looking for the right word here. I want to say we can sort of, abuse it, that I'll, you know, and I know people, because they've told me, you know, afterwards, I did this thing knowing I could confess it to the Lord. Nobody would know about it. Well, that's really not the spirit in which this is intended. You know, that's really presumptuous, you know, but I know Christians who thought that way. You know, and thankfully, if they're telling me, then they know that was wrong. But there's still that opportunity. We take something good, you know, and we can sort of abuse it, sort of misuse it.
I'm just surprised there's any animals left.
Really. I don't know. Maybe if you saw people getting killed or something like that.
The priest is like, no more. I can't eat anymore. No more. Please bring me some bread.
Yeah, really. I hope we get some poor people here. I'm tired of this.
Okay. Well, that's good, Mike. We appreciate you covering Leviticus 5. Why don't you tell us about your new events calendar on your website?
Oh, yeah. People should be aware that I've added an events calendar to the website. You can go to drmsh.com/events and you'll get the calendar. It's going to be incomplete. You know, when you look at it, you'll be able to scroll through months. At the bottom of the calendar, there'll be a little, you know, little thing to click on for the next month. If there's an event, you will see it described in terms of the location for whatever day it is. But if you click on any of them, sometimes there'll be full information. Other times it'll be something like, to be arranged or something like that. But I wanted to have some place where people are alerted to the fact that there are events happening. Right now, what we're looking forward to is there's an event in Missouri, October 2nd and 3rd coming up. There's going to be one in Plain City, Ohio on November 7th, I believe that is. I'm also booked for Denver in February, and still in negotiation for a couple other locations. There's one in Michigan that I'm talking to somebody in Michigan back and forth, and something in New Jersey. And I'm trying to think of where the other, I think there's one in Iowa or something like that. But there are three or four that are still in the state of, hey, we want to have you come, but we're trying to pick a date and trying to negotiate this with pastors and other area churches so that it'll work out and that kind of thing. So the events calendar is where you can sort of get caught up. I mean, I'd check it maybe once a week, see if anything's been updated there, but at least it's there.
Sounds good. Well, Mike, next week, we're going to have another special guest.
Yep. Yeah, we're going to be interviewing. We may have two, but at least one of the figures behind the, and I would say the major figure behind the character in The Portent, known as Fern. So if you've read the novels, The Facade and The Portent especially, there's a thread in both of the novels that relates to dissociative disorder, people who are deliberately traumatized either through satanic ritual abuse or, again, maybe an MK Ultra type program. There are people around the country who very much under the radar. I mean, I know some practicing psychologists that get these cases, but Fern, the character Fern is sort of representative of people I know who do this, a very under the radar, word of mouth kind of ministry, but they are literally busy every week. And she has a nonprofit ministry that caters exclusively to people who need, again, I'll call it counseling. There's more to it than that, that are in these situations. And the reason I'm having on is because she specifically uses lots of the kind of theology that you'll read about in Unseen Realm, Divine Counsel Worldview Theology, in the way she helps people process what happened to them and also recover from it. Now, dissociative disorder, for those who don't know, used to be called clinically multiple personality disorder. And it's everyone can dissociate voluntarily or you know, the best illustration is you're driving down the road and your mind literally, you go to a different place. And you can be thinking of something or playing something through your mind or whatever, but somehow you're on autopilot driving, but you are actually mentally in a different place. That's what dissociation is. And people who are into psychology know that if a person is traumatized, this is a natural brain function that helps them cope with the trauma. Their brain sort of breaks off into some other place or area where to insulate them from experiencing the trauma. And sometimes, again, there have been psychologists, people in and outside, in private practice and in the government, who use this to experiment on people to see if they could create alternate personalities within them and program those personalities to do different things, to be triggered. If you've ever seen The Manchurian Candidate, again, it's kind of an extreme illustration, but it is nevertheless an illustration. Sometimes this is drug-induced, whatnot, deliberate trauma. Well, is someone who focuses, has a ministry on this kind of stuff, whatever its point of origin, and helps people deal with that. And she's especially focused on people where you have real demonization occurring or something that involves ritual abuse and programming people for nefarious purposes and things like that. So I think she's an interesting guest because it's a good deal off the beaten path, but yet at the same time, I want her to explain to the audience how she finds the spiritual warfare stuff that is rooted in the text in its own original context. In other words, the Divine Counsel stuff, how she has found that useful in helping people. This is not deliverance ministry. It is actually pretty suspicious of deliverance ministry, to be honest with you. This is something different, and she has found the theology that many of you are very familiar with, very useful for what she does. So I thought it would be just, again, I'm bringing people into the orbit here that know the content pretty well and find it useful for whatever thing they do, whether it's just preaching, you know, just instructing people, or in case something more specific that you'd put into the counseling area, how they use it, how they find it effective. So I think it'll be a real interesting interview. I think people will find it, you know, pretty interesting.
Absolutely. Looking forward to that one. Mm-hmm. Anything else, Mike, you'd like to discuss?
No, I think that's it.
Okay, well, good deal. Just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.